KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's second forum hour, philosopher Jacob Needleman, author of The American Soul, wrestles with the concept and ideal of goodness in a new book called Why Can't We Be Good? He joins us in conversation for an hour that will include your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Jacob Needleman is professor of philosophy at San Francisco State University and the author of The American Soul, Lost Christianity, Money and the Meaning of Life, and The Heart of Philosophy. His newest book is called Why Can't We Be Good? And he joins us for this morning's second hour. Good to see you again. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Well, let's begin where you began, back in Jerusalem in about 10 A.D. It goes back to Hillel the Elder and some gentleman standing on one foot. I mean, a lot of wisdom distilled in that little anecdote.
It's a little gem. It's hidden in the Talmud. I've known about it. Many people know about it. But when I was contemplating this book, there it was, this young, brash, I suppose, but not without seriousness. The young man approaches Hillel the Elder. He's sort of a atheist. And it's only in two or three lines, and he says, I will convert to Judaism if you will teach me the essence of the Torah, of the whole Judaic tradition. If you will teach me the essence of the Torah while I am standing on one leg. Now, the story is he had asked another teacher who was ranked equally with Hillel, the same kind of thing, and he had been chased out of the room with a stick. But Hillel immediately replies, that which is hateful to you, do not do to others. That is the whole Torah. All the rest is commentary. Then he says, now go study. And that's the whole story.
Silver rule, golden rule, whatever we want to call it,
yes.
It's the foundation of so much, and it really is sort of the underlying essence of what we think of as goodness. And you get into the difficulty here of people who strive for goodness or who want this sense of living the golden rule or the silver rule or whatever, of making their inner ideal conform with their outer action, bringing the two into balance and having an ethical life. And it's a struggle for most of us.
Oh, it's a struggle. There's two aspects to the struggle. I don't know which one's more difficult, but one is trying to live according to what you know is good. But the second one, which is a lot of what this book is also about, is to struggle to acknowledge that you, in fact, do not do that. You do not live according to you so often betray your ideals. And the struggle to see that, to understand that, to go into that, that's missing in a lot of us.
It's also the importance, as you point out fairly early in your book, of intention and choice. That is the free ascent of the mind, I think is your phrasing,
yes,
as opposed to kind of automatic way of doing things.
Right.
By rote. Yeah.
Right. No. Without the free ascent of the mind, ethics becomes by rote, and you can easily be led into violence and hatred with that.
We're led in your book pretty early on into Plato and Socrates, where you've been grounded for years, even since high school, and that Miss Yoder, the librarian.
Yoder.
And we get a lot of Jerry Needleman's early life here for the first time in his work. But the idea of goodness, you know, as a radiating light that Plato had, and then as a student of Socrates, really teaching the fundamental notion of thinking together. It's a kind of communal thinking you're getting at here.
This is the thing I discovered right in front of my nose in class. What the bridge between what we know and how we act, what we feel to be good and how we behave, the bridge is missing. And I found that this bridge could be begun, you can begin to discover it in your classroom when you see what it means to listen to the other's point of view. Just that simple idea. But it's not so simple. It requires an act of intention toward your own thoughts, stepping back, making space, letting the other person's thought in. And that is a moral act. The work of thinking together to come to some resolution of difficulty, to understand each other, is a moral act. Or, as I say in the book, it's a rehearsal for morality.
It's ideally what goes on in the classroom, at least in philosophy classroom, isn't it?
Ideally, but in fact, most of the time when we are listening, we're trying to listen, we're actually listening to our own thoughts much more than to the other person, waiting for an opportunity to strike. It's not really listening, it's arguing. Listening, conversing, is very different from fighting. And I have students, I've made experiments with students trying to work at listening to each other, and adults too, and really trying to make room for the other's thought and repeat what the other said. And it's a miracle what happens. It's not that people start agreeing. They continue to disagree, perhaps, but it's that they relate to each other as human beings, and they disagree with the argument, with the thought, not with the person. And sometimes the strongest disagreements, people are really passionately against each other in their views, walk out arm in arm with each other.
Talking to Jacob Needleman, his new book is Why Can't We Be Good? Virtue? Is that what we're talking about
yes,
in part here?
Yes, virtue. Word
ethical doesn't... action and virtue are really almost identical in many ways?
I think so.
You go back to your own discoveries in high school and the emotionality and strong response of just that came from reading Plato and Socrates and so forth. But you get into this question fairly early on in the book about who the real teachers ought to be. I mean, and how one judges who the real teachers are as opposed to the charlatans, how one makes that distinction between, say, a real teacher. And it turns out that a real teacher is maybe a real seeker.
I think so. We're talking now about a teacher who is not just an academician, but actually is someone who can help another person reorient their character, reorient their life. And there's so many charlatans, there's so many people self-taught or self-initiated or teachers who are out there, particularly in San Francisco, that is one of the key questions that the book deals with in that particular section on Plato and Socrates. How do we recognize a real spiritual guide, a real existential teacher? And that's a question that it's one of the, this kind of thing, we're dealing in real philosophy, in my opinion, we're dealing with questions of the heart, not just of the head. And to answer, respond to those questions, you need the heart as well as the head. And when we just use intellectuality to deal with questions of value, we're using an instrument that is not designed for that purpose.
Do you need faith, too, especially when you're thinking of things like goodness and virtue and
faith?
These lofty notions? Yeah, faith. You mentioned spirituality. Or soul. Those words often are associated with
yes,
faith.
This is from the heart of religious teachings, but those words have often become cheapened and shallow in the religions that we read about and hear about and practice so often. So the word faith has to be defined very carefully. It's not just an intellectual belief or a passionate belief in something you can't prove. It's an activation of another instrument of knowing in the emotions.
Well, let me get into this in a kind of deeper way for a moment here, because you write about doing good and the importance of lofty and ennobling notions of good. But go back to Dostoevsky for a moment, Brothers Karamazov, when Ivan Karamazov says, if God does not exist, anything is possible. I mean, it's a Nietzschean idea. It's a very troubling idea, and it's a notion that somehow you could make evil your good. Baudelaire, Flowers of Evil. So forth. Iago. Why, if there's no faith, would one aspire to the good as opposed to, let's say, evil?
Well, as I said, we would have to define faith. There's a definition or an aspect or an experience of faith which is much deeper and more noble and more worthy of our serious respect than the usual things that are thrown around. But the Dostoevsky case, it is such a clear issue there. If there's no God, says Ivan, then anything is possible. But what is this God we're talking about? Some bearded old guy up in the sky who's pulling the strings, or some deep force in the universe and within ourselves that is really the source of value and meaning and service that we're out of touch with inwardly. I think it's the latter. If there's no source, objective source of value and good and meaning, yes, anything is possible. And life becomes despair, as it was with Yvonne so much.
Well, then how do we describe, I mean, if there's a sense of universal goodness that can be found within, which is, I think, pretty much one of the tenets that you're working with here, and certainly the tenets of so many faiths going all the way back to ancient times. We believe that human decency, kindness, and charity are all within us, but there's also that propensity toward evil. And you think about, say, a child who is loving as opposed to a child who likes to torture animals, let's say, or who likes to inflict pain. They're both out there, you know, the dove and the rattlesnake.
They're both out there, both in here, too. Both of them, the dove and the rattlesnake, are in human beings. There's a tendency toward externality, toward violence, even toward evil, let's say. And the Jewish mystical tradition has a very strong statement about the two inclinations, inclination toward the good, inclination toward the evil, called the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara. And those two are part of human nature. And the essential human quality, like in Plato's Phaedrus with the chariot, is that we need to put them in balance. And once these two inclinations are under the governance of this third principle, which is uniquely human, then it ceases to be poisonous.
Yeah, I was thinking about what your mother said to you, though, when you were a kid. Jerry, there are bad people in the world, right?
That gets me through a lot
of Well, but you're also saying, you're kind of positing the idea that we can find love within ourselves, that there's a universal human soul that can be tapped into that connects us to some kind of loving force.
I think we can. I don't think it's so easy. I think it needs work. It needs a community. It needs people who have worked at that. I don't think it's just so simple to do that. There are people who are maybe born more connected to that, thank God. But for most of us, it's a struggle.
You think it's our true identity, though. How do we know that? How do we?
Well,
I mean, that may be a matter of faith. Huh?
No, I don't think so. I think there's a general view, the usual accepted, maybe secular, scientistic, whatever you call it, view that we are just selfish animals with a super ego conditioned into us and a complicated computer on the top of our neck. But basically, we're just selfish, like even our genes are selfish. But that's just a point of faith of modern era. The ancient views, if you go deep enough, say that there's deep goodness within each of us. That's part of our nature, and that's what's gotten covered over. And over that covering, another covering has taken place. But when you penetrate, you step back from the ego, just for a moment, sometimes you're flooded with an awareness that, yes, I wish to love, I wish to serve. And then that gets covered over again. And that's why the work of listening to each other lets you just a little bit step back from the ego, which is usually led by your opinions. And when you step back from that ego and listen to the other, it takes work. You find there's a certain, as a teacher, I find a certain joy in just separating from my own opinions and letting this human being in.
It's an Eastern philosophy almost in some ways, or
yes,
it sounds like it. I mean,
it
in fact,
is.
You talk about the stripping away of appearances and self-knowledge as a moral force underneath the appearances.
It's very, very Eastern. It's expressed very clearly in the Buddhist tradition, but it's Christian and Jewish as well. People have to realize that we don't know very much about what's really in the Christian tradition and the Hebrew tradition. I can find word for word the same things we find in the Eastern traditions about this subject.
Also, the idea of choosing goodness within the moment and how important that is. I mean, you have a lot of allied concepts here, silence and sacredness and duty and all of these things, but it really comes down to often the choice, volition within the moment, the mindfulness within the moment. And sometimes you can choose good and unfortunately fraught with all kinds of consequences that are not so good. The choices can bring...
Absolutely. You know, you can choose one to be good and be mistaken in the long run. Your intentions can be good, and that is a noble thing. And in that sense, you're more or less not responsible sometimes for the consequences. But to really be deeply good as a permanent or reliable thing, I think you need to have some direction of contact with what we call conscience, which is not just a socially conditioned set of values, but an organ within the human psyche, which is part of our essential nature. That's not an act of faith. That's an absolute experience, which we all more or less have sometimes in our life.
Talking with philosopher Jacob Needleman, author of The American Soul. His new book is Why Can't We Be Good? Moral action has power to it.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about that. What is the nature of that power as you see it?
Well, it's a very... When people really... Let me just think about that. That's like one of those questions that one can't answer too quickly. But when you see what is moral, first of all, what is the moral action? When you see a person who is deeply concerned with others before himself, and you see he acts in that way and speaks in that way and even radiates in that way, you want to be with that person. You want to be influenced by that person. I remember years ago there was a reception, years and years ago, for Jacob Javits, and he had the Lou Gehrig disease at that time, and he couldn't do anything at all except hoarsely whisper into an amplifier. And there was a room full of San Francisco big shots, Willie Brown, everybody was there, all the power people. And when he was rolled into the room, suddenly everybody just became quiet and reverent, because this was clearly a man who was struggling to give and serve in spite of hopeless odds. I mean, it was just in his presence, in his being, you respected this man's struggle to help. That's all I can say. When you see real morality and not people faking it, when you really see a young person or anyone, now, I can't tell you a story that's in the book, I think, but yes, I think it is. But when I was teaching once in Mexico, it was, and there was a... Can I tell a story?
Sure.
Yeah. I was teaching in Mexico, and there was a young man in my class. This was in English. It was in a business school. He was a man of 35. He had a five-year-old boy, and they were decorating the Christmas tree. And out in front of at the doorbell, there was a beggar boy wanting something. And I'll make the story short. And the father said to his little boy, "Give him one of your toys." And the little boy picked up an old beat-up toy. And the father said, "No, give me your favorite toy." And the little boy balked and cried and said no. And the father was firm, calm, but very firm, "Give him your favorite toy." And he waited in the living room, and his little son picked up his latest toy and depressingly, glumly walked to the door, the front door. A few seconds later, the son came running back into the living room with his face glowing and said, "Daddy, can I do that again?" He discovered something in himself. Nobody was preaching at him. He discovered that...
This old man giving a push.
Gave him a push. The old man was like a Zen master for this little son. He discovered that there's something in him that the culture tells us you're happy by getting things. And then it preaches hypocritically, give, give, give. But this little boy discovered that it is joyous to give.
Discovered a generosity of spirit, which is, again, virtue, I suppose, or certainly
yes,
identifiable with virtue.
Yeah. But we can practice that. I found I can practice that in class up to a point. Then you walk out of the door, forget it. But in class, there is a rehearsal for morality.
Well, you write toward the end of the book about going over here in the North Bay to Branson School,
yes,
kind of Tony School in Ross, and meeting with kids there and getting a whole different perspective from these kids, these children, as you call them. Why do we get angry? Why are we destroying the earth? I mean, those kind of elemental questions, when you get them from kids out of the mouths of babes and all that sort of thing, bring one to a different level of consciousness that has to do with questioning.
Absolutely. These kids are hungry for those questions to be dealt with. It's in them. It's not, they don't have to read about it in the papers. They want to be good. They know something's wrong. They don't want it to be. They want to serve something bigger than themselves. Yes, sometimes it's mixed with egotistical things. But when I'm standing in front of those kids and they're asking those kind of questions, they're not showing off. They really want to know it. And that makes us go inside ourselves and try to answer them honestly. And if we don't know, we have to accept that we don't know, but we can honor their questions.
What do we do about all that apathy, though? I mean, you know, you talk about kids who care, they can be tapped into, they can be a catalyst to make them care and so forth. But I'm not talking about kids, obviously. Adults, just the apathy is staggering.
It's staggering.
And the egotism.
It's staggering. It's, people need to, we teachers, or any of us who have, need to be able to communicate our values in a fresh way, in an honest way, because we don't know how to speak to these. If you scratch the surface of 90%, 95% of these kids and adults, you're going to find a morally hungry human being who's just, but see, one of the things we've done with the field of ethics is to set it off, cut it off from the ultimate questions of meaning and the universe and purpose and immortality and all these questions. We've made it into something we think we can figure out with just our intellectual brain alone, but it's connected to these huge questions. In other words, in technical terms, we've separated ethics off from metaphysics, from cosmology, from ontology, using technical terms, and from questions of meaning and purpose. Whereas you look at ancient philosophy, like in Marcus Aurelius and Plato and others, philosophy had to do with living a good life. That was the fundamental, that's what Socrates brought to the whole table.
Do you know there are a lot of people who couldn't give a tinker's damn about philosophy or about moral questions, don't have a moral appetite. They want just, you know, the nice car or the kid who wants that nice new pair of designer tennis shoes or whatever, you know, I mean, labeled tennis shoes or whatever. And this stuff is deep, and this stuff is pretty much out of their realm, out of their interest.
Yeah, some people won't. That's okay. Let them. But
Jerry, you say this is in all of us. You say that, you know,
it is in all of us, except that sometimes it's so covered over you need dynamite and
and other explosives.
No, but it's in all of us. But not all of us are able to listen to that. They need help. Everyone needs some help. We need help in how we communicate it.
In fact, that may be a way of expressing goodness, isn't it?
Yes,
that is to provide that help. And
that's
to be
what I'm saying.
The midwife.
The midwife. And it doesn't mean we have to know the answers. We have to simply help to honor the questions. And first of all, to open the questions. Because the way these things are presented sometimes is moralistic, fundamentalistic, argumentative. And of course, most of us have run away from it. I ran away from it when I was young.
Well, what... I've got a book coming out in the fall, and one of the questions that I grapple with is the question that Sal Bellow first introduced me to when I was young. How does a good man live? And let's include women, obviously, because it shouldn't be just men that we're talking about here, nor is it. How does a good human being live? What does it mean to be good, really? I mean, you're taking that on here. That's maybe the biggest question of all, because it means how to be human and how to care about the community and the peoplehood that you are part of, doesn't it?
Well, obviously, these are questions that require time and reflection, and there's no kind of soundbite that's going to do justice to that. But a good man or woman cares for the human being in front of them. And maybe that care takes the form only of listening to them or honoring them in some way that you're not always concerned with your own well-being. Now, that can be expressed in thousands of ways, on a mass scale, on an individual scale. But somewhere, a good human being cares for others more in a way than he cares for his own satisfaction.
On that note, I'm going to give out the phone number and find out what our listeners think about goodness and how to be good and why we can't be good. Join us toll-free, 866-733-6786. We welcome your phone calls. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with social philosopher and philosophy professor at San Francisco State, Jacob Needleman. His new book is called Why Can't We Be Good? He'll be at Black Oak Books in Berkeley, 7 o'clock on March, 7:30, March 19th. That's Monday. And we're going to go to your calls here forthwith. Again, our toll-free number, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, is 866-733-6786, or send an email to us. We welcome hearing from you via email as well. And our email address is forum@kqed.org. So much of this goes down to the consideration, I mean, in terms of talking about goodness, consideration for the other, the ability to kind of break through the sometimes unbreakable boundaries of self and extend empathy?
Empathy is a great, empathy is a big version of that. Just interest and respect would be the first step. And then that will lead to empathy and compassion. But first you've got to learn how to separate just enough from your own intellectual ego and so forth, your emotional ego, just enough, just a little, to sort of see the other as a human being and not as a friend or an enemy.
Let's find out what our callers have to say. And we go, Ricardo, to you first. Good morning.
Hello, Michael. Good morning. And to your guests, good morning. And thank you for your pleasant and fantastic work, especially this morning on air, as we find out what morality is versus what we live by on this ground and foundation we're all stuck in. At some point in the past, Michael, I had read something called A Meditation for a Day of Breaking Bread. It was the quintessential initiation, and it was on your program.
And I recall. Yeah.
Pardon me?
I recall, yeah.
Yes. And in that regard, I would like to just mention certain tenets of that, that living by good conscience and compassion, right thought, and correct action, this all brings about the light of reason. And it has to be done by being a private man, and at this point, private woman in this world, instead of the public face that we all appear to have to follow on coattails, because that's the agreement we have in society as the great essence that we build our civilization on at this point, which we emulate everything that comes down from world leaders, national leaders with all their nationalisms and all their travails and problems within the world structure. And we need to become private men and women, as Socrates said, and live that first and be observers of ourselves privately and then go into the world and teach as a new group of world servers. I am one of them. And I work on this level constantly every day in teaching children, the parents that I reach, and coffee shops. And I'm trying to build this in my networking slowly but surely as people gravitate. We have something called the indigo children, just to throw out a phrase. There's a new group of children growing that will emancipate the society from this wreckage we're creating. War, strife, aggression, hate, all the antithetical values to constant goodness and goodness of character.
Let me get a response to your comments, Ricardo, from Jacob Needleman.
Yes.
Well, it's very, from what you've described, it's a very admirable.
Commendable indeed.
Indeed. And someday we'd like to sit down. I'd like to sit down with you with a cup of coffee and see how you're doing it and what you do, how you're facing the inevitable resistance and obstacles, not only outside, but inside of us that you obviously know about very well.
And you mentioned, Ricardo, thank you, Ricardo, for that call. And Ricardo mentioned the private and public selves, and I'm reminded, I alluded to Bello before in Seize the Day, one of his lesser-known novels. He talks about the real and the pretender self. The pretender self is the outside self that we show the world, or maybe we pretend is ourself, our authentic self, and deep within is a more authentic self.
Yes.
Soul, maybe.
Yeah. You'd call it
that. Kind of conforms to what you were saying.
It does. It, of course, it would have to go into it with each other to see if we mean exactly the same thing. But yes, that idea has to be really brought more into our culture.
And we'll bring more of our callers into the program. Bill, morning.
Hello. Can you hear me?
I hear you fine.
Okay. I find Dr. Needleman's comments very interesting, and it's on areas that I have reflected a great deal. And I think essentially he's speaking to how the heart is really the key, and that the mind must follow the heart. We've gotten out of balance because the mind is trying to lead the way, and it doesn't know the way. And in particular, what I have come to as a conclusion is that when you talk about being quite a bit, Dr. Needleman, that it seems to me, and you talked about meaning, and it seems to me if you throw away the notion of meaning simply as what a word means, but it, you know, meaning as in meaningful in one's life, that it inherently derives from being, and that being inherently is of the heart. So that's my comment, and I'll take it off my thing.
Right. Thank you for the comment. Jacob
well,
Needleman.
Great things in that statement need to unpack, but meaning, my view of what I'm trying to sort of establish in the book a little, is that meaning, human beings cannot be happy unless their life has meaning. And meaning can only come when we serve something greater than ourselves. So we are built to serve. We're not built to take. We're built to give. And when we discover that, and not in some false, phony, hypocritical, sentimental way, not some Pollyanna way, when we really start to learn how to give, we receive. So at that sense, I think the heart, see, in our modern scientific point of view of knowledge, knowledge comes from trying to get free of the emotions and look with the mind alone and the senses alone. And that's very good up to a point, except when you throw away the emotions, you may also be throwing away the deep feelings that come from the authentic self. And those are the source of knowing value. The reason we have such fundamentalism and such absolute relativism about ethics and values is that we have cut ourselves off from the source of knowing of that, which is deep in the heart of the authentic self.
Sometimes we can see, even in the authentic self, many shades of gray.
Oh, yeah.
And feel, on a deeper level, the heart divided against itself.
Absolutely. And that's what in the Jewish tradition, the deep tradition, you see that very carefully exposed. That you could, they sometimes speak of, we have two hearts, one toward God and the other toward God knows what.
Godlessness, maybe, yeah. Well, here's some emails from listeners. Kim says, one noted Buddhist teacher and psychotherapist once said, with tongue only, partly in cheek, when they passed out bodies, they passed out personalities, and it's one to a customer. Are you confident that we are fully in control, able to override a negative personality if one has been passed out to us moment by moment for a lifetime?
What we can't, is that the idea? Is that what he said?
Do we really have control, I think, is the question here, when personality may be sort of fixed or deterministic.
We don't have control in the long run unless we develop something, free ourselves from something, which is what the Buddhist tradition and practice is all about. The moment we begin to get a little free of our egoism, we do have control, but it's not we who control it, but this authentic energy within us. So I think it's not black and white. We are born without control, but we can develop it.
Here's a listener who says, teachers could model the golden rule by connecting intellectual points to actual individuals in the classroom and their concerns. This almost never happens. Instead, teachers elevate themselves. They feign impersonality, conceits. They limit their field of reference to their specializations. Does Professor Needleman see any way out of this? It's the whole enchilada.
It's the whole enchilada, but that's exactly what we're all trying. And of course, that's what we have to try to do. And of course, we fail. And of course, we stand up there conceited, frightened, like everybody else. But there are some of us who really are struggling in the way you describe. One student, one of the nicest things that was ever said to me was when a student came up at the end of a class and said, and she did not look like some brilliant, she said, Professor, you really want us to think for ourselves, don't you? And that, she said it as though she had never had a professor. It's like a revelation. So we're trying, my friend, we're trying.
There's a listener named Michelle who says, I think one of the questions we need to ask is, how do so many people lose their empathy? And one of the answers seems to be through religion and the way it creates otherness in those who believe differently.
Yes, I think what has happened to a lot of religious organizations and religious teachings is that they have been swallowed up by the same illusions, fears, false identities, and pretensions that the rest of us are. So they don't really help at all. They make it worse sometimes. But there are many people in the religious traditions of the world who are going deeper than that and looking for something that's quite, quite liberating. So don't give up.
And on the note of religion, Jason, I believe you have something apropos.
Yes, I wanted the professor to comment on the idea that religion is, at least I believe, an artificial construct, and that until we do the right thing because it's the right thing to do, as opposed to out of fear of some father figure,
that we won't really evolve as a society. And also, if you wouldn't mind speaking to the idea that humankind has been conditioned by nature to be inherently selfish and self-centered as a survival mechanism. And I'll take my answer off here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Jacob Needleman.
Well, there's two aspects of one of them. The second one, the last one, is that we are born selfish, is putting it in a simplistic way. And I don't think that's necessarily true. That's the general accepted worldview, scientific or whatever kind of view. And and of course, observing human nature, you certainly have a lot of evidence to support that. But the evidence of the contemplative and really sophisticated traditions of contemplative work show quite the opposite. We are born with a goodness inside of us. It's just, it's hidden. It's covered over by a society that has lost its way. Now, the other one is, I agree with a lot of what that said, but there's a whole view now around a kind of a debate, which is very troubling, between a fundamentalist, or literalistic fundamentalist view and an atheism asserting itself to be the only realistic, sensible view. And neither one of those views really reflects what's really going on at the heart of the great religious teachings of the world. The God delusion and all that sort of thing is really doesn't have much of an idea of what the depth of religion really is about. And therefore, we have to wonder if they really understand what the depth of a human being it really is all about. With the God that we create is not the God that is being spoken of here. The God that creates us is something else, but that's not, that's only symbolized by a big human figure with a beard sticking his finger at on Michelangelo or something. That's a symbol. And people don't realize that symbols are not reality. Symbols reflect or tell us about reality.
I was thinking about your story about the kid in Mexico who gave away his favorite toy. And there used to be a bumper sticker that said, "The one who has the most toys wins," which you may recall.
Oh, I remember it very well.
And that kind of acquisitiveness or that notion that so many, unfortunately, in American culture, seem to have had bred in them, it's all about me type of notion. It's again, a pretty formidable influence on so many lives. It's kind of difficult to think how it can be exorcised, even if you're right about what's authentically underneath that.
Yeah, no, it's not easy. None of this is easy. It's hard, and you need help, and you need thought, and you need people you feel have some understanding. And that's what we have to look for. This book, I like to say only half-jokingly, I'm a philosopher, and philosophers, we don't do answers. We do questions, but you can open.
Why does a philosopher answer a question with another question? Why shouldn't a philosopher answer a question?
Well,
I'm sorry, you were about to say
I think I don't. That's I like that that way. I think we have to recognize that there are questions like this which are difficult, and they need to be opened up, and we need to listen to each other and think together. And just because we don't have a quick bumper strip answer, and we don't have a soundbite answer, we don't have something you can put on a TV show, those questions have got to be deepened and reflected upon together with other people in what I call philosophical friendship. That's one of our great hopes.
And maybe not answered even.
No.
Just reflected.
If you ask a question deeply enough, the answer will be in your state of being that you come to, and then you will see what it means to be good.
But answers are, and in fact, what it means to be good, just like any answers that we're talking about here in a philosophical realm, are in flux, aren't they?
Well, on a surface level, yes, because what is good for me in one country is bad in another country, another culture, another ethnic group. Morality is like a chameleon that changes. But underneath it, you will find in every culture, almost everywhere, the same fundamental principles of love, kindness, justice. They don't differ down, way down under the surface. But on the surface, yes, they differ.
We'll bring on more of our callers. We'll go next to Paul. Morning, Paul.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having this program this morning. It brought to mind the things that have brought me to where I am today. And there was a seminal moment in my childhood. I was destructive and selfish and I would break toys and things like that, even when I was at someone else's house. And one day, I found a broken toy, and I put it back together, and I handed it to my my neighbor, and I've never forgotten that moment. It was a seminal moment for me, and as I look back through my life, I see that it's possible in an instant, I think, to experience what you're talking about in personal service, unconditional personal service. And for me, I have grown through having a child that I raised, and I took all of her questions very seriously and answered them to the very best of my ability. I'm a real estate broker, and we have high ethics, believe it or not. And through my experience as a real estate broker in taking personal care of my clients on a one-to-one basis where I'm providing unconditional service, I have actually grown and become more aware of my morality. And then further, one more thing is I belong to the Rotary Club, and I also belong to the Masons. Both organizations stress unconditional service to your fellow human being on a one-to-one basis. And I really do believe that anybody can experience what you're talking about in a moment if they provide unconditional personal service to another individual.
That's a beautiful account. I just think it's absolutely right on. In that story about putting something together, it's just the moment we need to experience. It's what I call, and in the book, moral mysticism. It's an experience that you cannot describe until you've actually done it. And so thank you for that.
Thank you, Paul. And we go next to Gloria. Morning, Gloria.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having this program. This is very interesting for me because I seem to be having this conversation last night with my 20-year-old daughter, almost this exact conversation. She is in college studying mathematics. She has a gift for mathematics and wanted to go into physics. And she has, although she has a very heavy schedule, she has been becoming very involved in volunteer work and works at a homeless shelter, works with disabled kids, and also works at a hospital. And from this volunteer work, she was telling me last night that she was thinking of changing her major and getting into helping people and maybe ending up founding a nonprofit organization. My argument to her was just that she has a gift for the math. She's very, very good at it. And she was telling me that she thought that I was looking at the bigger picture, because my argument was that we need people to be asking those big questions that Einstein was asking and to be doing that mathematics, because I think that there's so much out there that we still haven't found. And it's right out there, and we need to ask those questions and find those things that I think are going to bring humanity to higher levels. And she said to me almost what Jacob Needleman said, that I was looking at the picture too big, that it was more important to care for the person that's right in front of you, to do the little thing. And I don't know if there's a way to bring those two together. And that's really my question and my comment. And I'll take his comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Gloria. Jacob Needle.
Well, it sounds like you're having just the kind of conversations with your daughter that are necessary. And if you keep having conversations like this, she will find her own. I'm sure she will find herself respected, accepted, and at the same time challenged by your questioning. And my guess is this is a situation in flux and dynamic, and eventually she'll choose the path of her own, what she really is called to do, and that will bring everything, all her gifts into play one way or the other. I think you'll be surprised.
We go to some of our emails. This is from Phil, who says, "While I agree completely that the general problem of our society is self-focus rather than other-focus, there are many people who put others first to a fault, neglecting themselves, sacrificing themselves for what they perceive as the benefit of others, even if they're not accurate in that perception. These individuals are often taken advantage of and greatly harmed in our society. Isn't there something toxic inherent in this moralistic idea of service when it goes to the extreme of becoming a martyr?"
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there's a great when in the Bible, when Jesus says, "Be you clever as serpents and harmless as doves," he's not saying be harmless as serpents and clever as doves. In other words, you have to be aware of your worldly self and your common sense and your realism at the same time you're trying to do what is good. Otherwise, not only will you fail like you're describing, but you won't be able to do good very well unless you know the world you're living in. There's another saying, this one comes from the Islamic tradition, which I like very much, which is, trust in Allah, but tie your camel first.
Here's a listener who says, excellent topic, but I feel the conversation thus far has been very shallow. It seems that you have already concluded that compassion or service are good and selfishness is bad. I wanted to point out that even those are just intellectual concepts advised by prevailing culture, and you have not established a foundation for making such statements. In the interest of brevity, I would like to suggest two excellent books on nature of reality and thought by a physicist, David Baum, Thought as a System, and Wholeness in the Implicate Order, Mark.
Things can only be done so much. Come to my class. You're welcome to sit in. But as to David Bohm, I knew him very well. We were friends. And his idea about the ethics of conversation and listening is exactly what I'm talking about in the book. So thanks for the comment.
I think it's important, writes Dave, to point out that the golden rule has to be practiced preemptively. So many people say they will act morally when and only to the extent that others do. This doesn't work, and it turns the whole notion on its head. Here's another listener, Scott. It says, I watched an unedited video on the PETA website last night as a man in China skinned a dog alive. When the four-minute act was over, the man just tossed the still-live dog on a pile of other dogs and continued to laugh and talk off camera. The last frames are of the skinned dog lifting its head in shock at the inhuman act that had just happened to him. My question is about the man. Regardless of economic hardships, isn't there just a basic level of humanity, existing where the man would just throw down his knife and say that this is wrong?
Well, look at the world and you will find unbelievable, massive cruelty and injustice and brutality. This is just one of a billion such cases. It go even far beyond that of skinning not just dogs but human beings by the millions in one way or the other. We live in a world rent and soaked in evil. So that's not the issue. The issue is how can I be what a human being is meant to be? And a few of those, some of that action could be a tipping point, actually, in the larger scale of the world. We don't know how balanced it all is, that a few people, or that is to say, a small percentage of people trying, honestly, could actually make a difference.
Bob, you're on. Thank you for joining us. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
This is Bob. I just wanted to thank Professor Needleman. He gave me some advice. I'm a martial arts teacher. I had some personal contact with him, and he helped me to refocus my own training and teaching so that it really became kind of a process of the deep listening that he's talking about, and also experiencing the gap between our good intentions and our capability at a certain point in time to actualize those good intentions. Experiencing that gap is one way that you can get better.
Yes. Experiencing the gap.
Professor.
I'm sorry. I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, I just said thank you.
Well, thanks. Thanks for calling in.
What are we going to say about the gap, though, Jim?
To really face that gap, to experience it, without immediately reacting and trying to do better and becoming a moral person, in quotes, just to suffer that is one of the great secrets, because when you suffer that really intentionally and patiently, it's a suffering that opens the door to conscience. And conscience is the greatest guide to morality. But it requires a sincerity of seeing how far you are from what you are meant to be. That's what I'm trying to
establish. You also need Jiminy Cricket in many instances, you know, to be on your shoulder.
You need him, but you have to listen to him when he chirps.
You listen to that, you know, that angel on the one hand with the halo and that creature with the pitchfork on the other
That's
side.
That's right.
Here's Kevin who writes, just interested to hear what you have to say about this with your philosophy background. He said, thank you both for the show today. I have been reading John Stuart Mill's writing on utilitarianism. In short, do what is best for the greater good. Can your guest chime in on his thoughts of Mill's work and any shortcomings he sees with that position?
It's a very admirable principle. What Mill knows, it needs to be developed more subtly, with more complexity. But happiness is one of the words it's a weasel word. And what exactly is happiness? How the greatest happiness for the greatest number is really fine. But what does it mean? Does it mean the most goods, the most consumer goods? Does it mean what? And maybe when people are handing out texts or teaching or poetry or music, that's making more happiness than even economic progress. So what you're saying is the invitation to a long, thoughtful discussion, preferably over a nice, let's say, cup of coffee.
I like that weasel word. Never heard that before. We're the only nation, though, that guarantees, not only life at liberty, but the pursuit of happiness.
Right. When Jefferson was writing about that, he said many things about that. Virtue, without virtue, no happiness.
Let me try to, I'm afraid we probably don't have time, unfortunately, for another caller. My apologies, but we're running out of time here. Time goes quickly when you're with Jacob Needleman. In fact, we once had a discussion about how quickly time goes.
If you may recall,
as you get older, it seems to go faster. He'll be at Black Oak Books, 7:30 Monday in Berkeley. And the book is, again, Why Can't We Be Good? Always good to see you.
Well,
thank you,
wonderful
sir.
To be here, Michael.
We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour's repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Want to extend thanks to our producers, Robin Giannatasio Ma, Hermione G, and Kevin Guillory. Thanks to you, our listeners. We are certainly grateful for your listenership and wouldn't be here without you. And want to thank our engineer, Danny Bringer. Remind you that we always enjoy hearing from you. If you have something you'd like to say or to ask us about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or call the listener call and response line at 415-553-3300. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez, and for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.